Everyone, and welcome to the New Diplomatist Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Garrison Morado, and today I'm very honored to have joining me expert on Russia, Mr. Paul J. Saunders. Mr. Saunders, welcome to the New Diplomatist Podcast.
Thank you, Garrison. A pleasure to be with you.
Now, Mr. Saunders, would you mind introducing yourself to the listeners when it comes to some of your experienced background when it comes to Russia, as well as your work in energy innovation and reform and the Center for the National Interest?
Sure. No, I'd be happy to do that. So I'm currently president of Energy Innovation Reform Project. We're a research and advocacy organization focused on kind of practical bipartisan solutions to energy and climate challenges. And I've been here at EIRP for the last couple of years. Before that, I was for about 15 years the executive director of a foreign policy think tank called the Center for the National Interest. In that capacity and in some of my earlier career, I was an appointee at the State Department and before that was also at the Center for the National Interest. Really spent a lot of time focusing on U.S.-Russia relations, U.S. policy toward Russia, Russia's foreign policy, Russia's foreign energy policy, and a variety of other topics.
Well, it's a wealth of information and knowledge base to bring to the podcast, and I know that our listeners appreciate it. You know, I want to get right into some of the current news that just came out even yesterday, and it should sit right at the cross-section of that expertise on Russia and your work in energy, which is the Biden administration's decision to waive sanctions against the company overseeing the construction of Russia's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline in Germany. And this has received some bipartisan blowback in Congress, if you will, and appeals from various Eastern European governments in particular to reconsider. Maybe we should start just kind of unpacking this decision. What is your view on the Biden administration's action to waive these sanctions, and what do you think it portends for the future of U.S.-Russian relations in the energy sector in Europe?
Well, I would put the decision really in a broader context, and, you know, to the extent that I can tell, I think that the Biden administration really views China rather than Russia as the principal foreign policy and national security challenge to the United States. I think they want to concentrate on that challenge. I think they view, from their perspective, many of the things that the United States needs to do to address the China challenge as kind of, on the one hand, really working very closely with our allies, obviously in the region, but also elsewhere. And on the other hand, kind of making a variety of domestic investments that are going to put the United States in a better position to compete with China. I think that's their perspective. I think from that perspective, I think it makes a lot of sense to explore whether the United States can de-escalate somewhat this very challenging relationship that it has with Russia, while at the same time, building bridges, especially to Germany, where the kind of relationship with the United States really suffered a great deal under President Trump and certainly around the Nord Stream issue, which is really a key issue for Germany and a leading concern here in the U.S. So I see what the administration is trying to do as a way to kind of try to reconcile these multiple different objectives of, you know, de-escalating a little bit with Russia, helping to build this bridge back to Germany, and again improving our position as a country to focus on the challenge from China. But obviously, you know, there are people domestically who are more concerned about Russia than about China, or alternatively, who feel that we, you know, kind of can and should really confront both of them at the same time. And certainly, you know, looking to our European allies, you know, not every NATO member has the same, or every EU member, for that matter, has the same view of the pipeline. And certainly for the countries that are, you know, kind of currently earning transit fees from gas that's going from Russia through pipelines on their territory to Germany or elsewhere in Europe, you know, it's undesirable to have a competing pipeline, particularly one that's newer and will have very significant capacity. And you know, obviously, some of those countries also have security concerns about Russia and kind of long-standing historical reasons for discomfort about Moscow and its intent.
Well, you're right in saying that this is definitely a move to try and reduce those tensions and pursue a close relationship with Germany, which was obviously infamously strained during the Trump administration years. Speaking about historical context in the European outlook and between the U.S. and Russia, in preparation for this podcast, as we were discussing a little bit before we hit record, I went back and found some of your earlier lectures and topics you were covering earlier on in your career, as much as 15 years ago, in 2006, in a speech for the Dole Institute for Politics, where you were outlining, is it time to give up on Russia, was the question of the lecture. And of course, the answer that you provided at the end of that was no, but we do deserve to take a new approach. And it was a fascinating moment to look back on now, because it's 15 years ago from as we speak, roughly. And at the time, in 2006, it was 15 years or so on from the collapse of the Soviet Union. So we have a neat double arc there. In 2006, that summer, the G8 was held in Russia. The Georgia crisis had not completely blown open yet. Ukraine had not completely blown open yet. The reset hadn't happened under President Obama. And of course, the 2016 election meddling crisis was also not yet a thing, full decade later. And yet you stood at that time and you said that you felt that the increasing assertiveness from Russia that you saw mounting was not something that the United States was prepared to deal with, that we were not positioned properly. And then if we didn't handle it correctly, that it was going to lead people to think that not every that this was not a very useful or constructive relationship for the U.S. to pursue. And so dovetailing off of these rather prescient observations, yeah, in 2006, I want to ask some questions regarding how did we get from the G8 being held in Russia and so much still attempts at optimism, still kind of a post-Cold War attempt to reframe relationship with Russia, through multiple, I would say, largely failed strategies to engage Moscow, to the present day?
Well, there's a lot of history there, and I'm not sure that we have enough
time. Sure, it's a big question. It's a big question. But maybe particularly regarding, you mentioned energy as a particularly potent point of leverage in Russia's arsenal. At the time, it was riding very high as an economy because oil prices were high. Of course, with the sanctions, that gets reduced. Maybe zone in more on the energy aspects. Do you feel that the sanctions that were, you know, leveled against the Russian economy during the Ukrainian crisis and so on, that has actually, you know, curtailed the ability of that relationship? Or what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe I'll go actually in slightly a different direction for a minute here, and I'll try to come back to that.
Sure.
I think really the fundamental question that has not yet been answered has to do with, you know, what is Russia's role in Europe and in the European security architecture, and for that matter in Russia's own neighborhood. You know, there was this idea kind of very early on that we would have this big community extending, you know, from kind of the Atlantic all the way to the Pacific, across Europe and Russia and Eurasia. And it was kind of all one community, and people would live in harmony and peace, right?
Yes.
And you know, we didn't quite get there, and I think a lot of that had to do with not really figuring out how to fit Russia into that. And you know, initially there was an idea of, you know, this NATO-Russia Council or other kind of instruments for coordination between NATO and Russia. And, you know, we were never really able to come up with a good formula. What people liked at the time in the West was the idea of Russia having a voice but not a veto. That was the formulation that was often used. And, you know, from a diplomatic perspective, that's something that sounds really terrific because, you know, Russia has a voice, right? So it can participate in these discussions of European security, but, you know, we're not going to allow Russia to determine the outcome, right? So it sort of sounds like something that's really attractive as a concept. In practice, I think, you know, from the Russian perspective, having a voice was kind of useless if their voice couldn't affect the outcome of these decisions, right? So that's kind of like having, from their point of view, no voice at all. And I think that's where this whole relationship ultimately foundered, really, is on kind of this question of, you know, what are Russia's legitimate interests in kind of the European and Eurasian space? And to what extent are the United States and the West, you know, prepared to accommodate Russian interests or to try to address them versus kind of operating strictly on the basis of our own interests? And that's the thread that I think really ties all of it together. You know, whether you're talking about Georgia and the 2008 intervention, or kind of the economic and energy related disputes with Ukraine, and ultimately the 2014 total unwinding of the Russia-Ukraine relationship and Russia's, you know, seizure of Crimea and its intervention in eastern Ukraine. And obviously, you know, when the Russian government decides to invade another country, you know, that's their decision and they're responsible for it. At the same time, you know, it's a decision, and both of those decisions, I mean, in Georgia and in Ukraine, they were decisions that the Russian government took in context of events at the time. You know, Russia could have taken Crimea back from Ukraine at any point, really, after Ukraine became an independent country. It did. That happened in 2014. You know, kind of why? So we probably don't need to go much further in this direction. Just to reiterate, I think the central question is, you know, kind of what is Russia's role in this space? How are we kind of prepared to permit Russia to operate in that space? What Russian interests are legitimate? What Russian interests aren't? These are the questions that we have to answer, and you know, certainly that the Biden administration is going to have to answer if they try sort of systematically to de-escalate in that relationship.
Well, yes indeed. And you know, kind of dovetailing off of that further, I'd not to spend too much time in the past, but it struck me again in your past lecture, you had mentioned the areas for potential cooperation between Russia and the United States being on energy outlook, as well as on countering terrorism and preventing proliferation, you know, non-proliferation efforts. Do you still feel that those are still opportunities on the table, even 15 years on, for the United States and for the Biden administration to pursue? I mean, obviously, energy is still a discussion because of Nord Stream 2, we just touched on, but the terrorism aspects, non-proliferation aspects, do you think those are still good routes forward for the relationship, or has it so altered that we need to pursue a new line of engagement?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, to be honest, I think looking for a cooperative agenda with Russia is pretty challenging. Mm. I think if I were in government and in a position to influence the administration's approach, I think I would focus on trying to de-escalate the relationship, on trying to create more structure and predictability in the relationship, hopefully over time, using the structure, the predictability, and the de-escalation to kind of gradually restore mutual trust, which has really been profoundly undermined for, you know, a variety of reasons, you know, certainly in the United States, starting with the election interference, but, you know, not at all limited to that. And on the Russian side, you know, they have their own list of grievances vis-a-vis Washington. So I think I would really just focus on stabilizing the relationship at this point, trying to make it a more functional relationship. And perhaps in the future we can look at areas to cooperate in. I think that's not the first step. You know, certainly if we were looking for areas to cooperate now, I think, you know, it's notable that Secretary Blinken and Minister Lavrov had their recent meeting on the margins of the Arctic Council. You know, that's certainly a region that has not yet become as fraught as some of the other regions where we interact with Russia. And it's an area where we have, you know, some common interests, starting with climate change, you know, that we could try to look to. I think there are some other, you know, relatively narrow and discrete areas where we could, over time, you know, look for a cooperative agenda, not quite there yet.
Do you think that if some of those events were to begin taking place, and obviously perhaps taking Nord Stream 2 as an example of a first step or a baby step in the direction of de-escalation on the part of the Biden administration, what are the chances of a G8 returning? Is that a dead and gone idea as a concept? Are we stuck with a G7, or does Russia have a path back, do you think?
I think that's dead. I think it's dead. I mean, first of all, I don't think the Russians really want to come back. Obviously, you know, if they don't want to, then what anybody else, yes, you know, yeah, might want is kind of less relevant. But I don't really see how something like that would work. So I would kind of put that off the table, really for the foreseeable future. And look, you know, there are already plenty of other multilateral organizations where the United States and Russia are both members. And, you know, in that economic context, I would kind of point first to the G20, which actually I think is, you know, becoming increasingly important anyway as the sort of aggregate share of G7 members in the global economy declines, you know, because, you know, many of the large developing economies, you know, China, India, others, you know, get bigger and bigger, right?
Yes.
So I wouldn't really put a lot of effort into trying to put the G8 back together again.
Now, for two quick final questions, sir, because I do want to be respectful of your time, which is very valuable, and we appreciate you coming on today. You mentioned at the outset that the Biden administration, and I would say very much in this sense, ironically, in line with the Trump administration, recognizing the threat of China as a long-term great power competition with a very economic bent to it. How does Russia fit into that triangular relationship of 2.5 or 3 great powers, depending on how you look at it? You know, in terms of the Cold War, it's very infamous, the Nixon-Kissinger engagement with China meant to balance the Soviet Union. Is this, you know, a potential opportunity for the United States to de-escalate with Russia to balance China, or is that too much historical referencing?
Well, I think I would not really try to think about it in those terms for a variety of reasons. I think the most important reason actually is that people in Russia and people in China actually remember what President Nixon did.
Yes, indeed.
It's a little bit harder to do something like that a second time. In an environment in which neither of them really wants to be either used in that way in the Russian case or sort of the victim of that in the Chinese case. So I think having had that success already one time, it's something we're unlikely to be able to pull off a second time. But, you know, there's also really another factor there, at least from my perspective, as I think about geopolitics and what it means to be a great power. You know, I believe that, you know, one of the core requirements of being a great power is that your own immediate neighborhood is kind of a benign environment for you, because how can you really be a global player in a local environment in which you're kind of constantly distracted by various different kinds of crises with your neighbors, and particularly looking at Russia and China, who you know obviously have many neighbors weaker than themselves, and you know some neighbors that are members of U.S. alliances. You know, in order to have that kind of stability in their neighborhoods, I think one of their cardinal requirements is to manage their own relationships in a way that allows them to focus on other things. And I think both of them recognize that. I think both of them want that. And I think that puts kind of a certain lower boundary on where the Russia-China or China-Russia relationship really can go. And I don't think that either government would be prepared to accept the damage to their mutual relationship that would come from aligning with the United States in a way that directly threatened the interests of the other party. So as a practical matter, I think the best you can really do when you're looking at that triangle, if you're focused on China as the problem, you know, is to try to get Russia to a place where it's kind of not overwhelmingly dependent on China and is in a position, you know, kind of to side with China on some things and to side with the United States or with the Europeans or, you know, for that matter, with India or with somebody else, you know, on other things. So that Russia has, and this is going to sound a little bit weird, but actually so that Russia has a little bit more strategic room for maneuver than it does as a government that's really sort of solidly in an alignment with China. And that would allow the United States and our allies and others actually to be working with Russia in ways that, you know, maybe China wouldn't like and might even help us in various different ways in our competition with China, but, you know, wouldn't directly threaten core Chinese interests and therefore would be kind of on the menu, you know, that Russia might consider.
And I want to fit in one last very short question for the end here, which is, given your expertise, sir, on the energy outlook of the United States with your work at EIRP, as well as obviously your expertise in Russia, do you have any comments regarding the recent hacking of the Colonial Pipeline cybersecurity systems that caused such a disruption to gas supplies in the United States from a Russian-tied hacker gang, DarkSide? Do you have any thoughts about what that portends or...
Sure. I mean, I guess the first thing I would say is that, you know, the United States has, I think, made fairly clear that they do not view that as something that the Russian government ordered or orchestrated or, you know, is responsible for. Certainly, the group does appear, you know, to have... kind of links in Russia or Central Europe. I assume we'll find out more over time. I guess, you know, for me, it just really highlights the profound vulnerability of much of our infrastructure, you know, energy and otherwise, to these kinds of attacks. And I think it's something that really has to kind of fundamentally change how we look at America's vulnerability vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And, you know, I would say historically there's been kind of a view that, well, you know, we have this incredibly strong conventional military force, really the world's leading. We have a massive nuclear arsenal. We have basically friendly neighbors, and we have the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. So, you know, what do we really need to worry about?
Yes, yes, that, indeed.
That's kind of a view that many have taken, and you know, things like this show that you know this. I don't know how big the group is, how many people are involved, but, you know, ultimately we're talking about kind of a group of people.
A non-state actor, yeah.
A non-state actor and a fairly small budget, actually, able to really kind of wreak this great disruption. And, you know, it's interesting from some of their comments in the media, appears that they didn't really realize actually what the consequences of their their actions would be, you know, which also kind of highlights actually in a way how so many of us around the world, governments, non-state actors, others, you know, as the world becomes more complex, the kind of ripple effects, unintended consequences, et cetera, you know, from decisions that individuals and governments take really can be very unpredictable. So anyway, I would just point to the dangers and really the need to take a very hard look at protecting our key infrastructure systems. And, you know, the toughest part of that, figuring out who's going to pay for it.
Yes.
Somebody always has to pay for it. And you know, that's been one of the big obstacles so far, but I really hope we'll kind of come together as a country and a political system and find a way to deal with that.
Well, on that note, and I second that opinion completely, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up for the day. But, sir, it has been an absolute honor to have you on the New Diplomats podcast. Thank you for sharing your wisdom and your expertise on all subjects, energy and Russia. And I hope to have you back again on the podcast very soon.
Thanks so much. Happy to do it, and best wishes to you.
Thank you, sir.